Hello, everyone. I'm Richard Bonney, and I'm the director of the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, and a member of the faculties of the Schools of Law and Medicine. And I want to welcome you to the 11th P. Browning Hoffman Memorial Lecture. In addition to the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, this lecture is also co-sponsored by the Institute on Aging at the University of Virginia, and we're very, very pleased to actually have arranged this partnership for Rebecca Dresser's lecture. Outside, you may have noticed there's a table with various materials provided by the Institute on Aging, and those of you who are not aware of the Institute and the many things that it does, I encourage you to take a look at the materials after the lecture. I should also say that afterwards, there will be, of course, a period of some discussion, I hope, before we adjourn the lecture, but there's also a reception, as you can see, and everyone, of course, is invited to stay and speak informally with Rebecca. I'm going to say a few words not only about her, but also about Browning. This lecture is, of course, a tribute to the memory of Browning Hoffman, a psychiatrist who joined the UVA faculty in 1971, held joint appointments in the schools of medicine and law, founded the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, and laid the groundwork for other programs in law and medicine. He did this with extraordinary energy and creativity until his work was cut tragically short by a sudden death in 1979. The period of Browning's work, basically the 1970s, was a time of rich ferment in law and mental health, intellectually speaking, both in both of the domains of law that make up this field, concerned with the rights and needs of people with mental disabilities, and also the use of mental health expertise in the law, and especially in criminal adjudication. This excitement of that period spawned a new generation of scholars in both law and psychiatry, and as well as other mental health specialties, working at the intersection of these two disciplines. Among this generation of new scholars was Browning, myself, my colleague John Monahan, who unfortunately, or fortunately for him, is in Italy at the present time, and six of our previous Hoffman lecturers, as well as our lecturer today. Before introducing Professor Dresser, I want to say a few personal words about Browning. He had a passion for ideas and an awesome intellectual energy. On literally hundreds of occasions over the 5 years that we worked together, he would come into my office, plop down in the easy chair, saying, "I need to rattle your cage." And off he would go into his latest effort to solve what might have appeared to others as an intractable problem. He was a man with a mission, interdisciplinary collaboration, and he viewed his own job as building bridges between the disciplines in professional education and in policymaking settings. He had a clear vision of the possibilities, and he put many of them into place within a very few years. A forensic clinic in which students from all the disciplines learned together in the context of conducting actual evaluations for the courts, the institute itself, and fellowships, postgraduate fellowships in all the relevant disciplines. To his friends and colleagues, Browning's death was made especially tragic by a sense of promise unfulfilled. Yet Browning himself had a different view. He told me at his hospital bedside that he felt that he had already accomplished most of what he set out to do. I have no doubt that imminent mortality had scaled down his ambitions, but he did, in fact, accomplish a remarkable amount in his 8 years here. He left an enduring legacy for which hundreds of students and residents at the Schools of Law and Medicine at the university owe him a great debt. I know that Browning would have been pleased that this lecture in his memory is being delivered by Rebecca Dresser, the Daniel Noyes Kirby Professor of Law and Professor of Ethics and Medicine at the Washington University in St. Louis. Prior to coming to the Washington University, Professor Dresser taught at Baylor College of Medicine and held joint appointments in the Schools of Law and Medicine at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. A short biographical sketch appears in the handout that you received at the door, so I will not repeat what is you can read there. But what I do want to add is an unequivocal scholarly judgment that would be out of place in such a descriptive summary. Over a period of about 25 years, she has made genuinely distinctive intellectual contributions on an extraordinary range of subjects in law and bioethics, including treatment of people with mental disabilities, end-of-life decision-making, protection of human research subjects, and a vast and growing arena of regulating reproductive technologies. She has also explored the intriguing issues relating to use of animals in research and more generally the moral status of animals. Her thoughtful and provocative work in many of these areas has been reprinted in numerous anthologies. The breadth of her work and her independence of mind made her a truly outstanding choice to serve on the President's Council on Bioethics, to which she was appointed in 2002. Let me now focus on the portion of her work that leads to this podium today. Professor Dresser received her law degree in 1979 from Harvard, where she came under the wing of the first Hoffman lecturer, Dr. Alan Stone. She then was awarded an NIMH-funded postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where she also served as a volunteer mental health attorney. During these years, a genuinely exciting period, as I've already indicated, of intellectual innovation in law and psychiatry, she wrote a number of provocative articles exploring the tension between respect for autonomy and the demands of benevolence in treating patients with psychiatric problems. Her topics included refusal of treatment and food by patients with anorexia nervosa, competence of severely depressed patients to refuse electroconvulsive therapy, and the potential usefulness of so-called Ulysses contracts by psychiatric patients who, while competent, want to prescribe or preclude certain treatments in the event of later deterioration. On this later topic, her work anticipated what has now become a growing interest in so-called psychiatric advance directives among mental patient advocacy groups. Like so many people who were intrigued by the ethical and legal conundrums of law and psychiatry in the 1970s and 80s, Professor Dresser became interested in the regulation of research to protect vulnerable populations, especially people with mental disorders. Her important contribution to this area brought her to Charlottesville in 1997 on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, when she presented a paper on the continuing failure of the federal research establishment to provide sufficient safeguards in studies involving participants with mental disabilities. Professor Dresser's early work on competence and mental disorder led her to the rich philosophical literature on personal identity and the moral and legal implications of permanent disruptions or alterations of one's understanding of oneself. This brings us to the edge of her topic today. She became interested in the ethics of making decisions on behalf of people with dementia at a time when the law was gradually embracing an autonomy-driven approach to end-of-life care, one which purports to anchor these momentous decisions in the preferences and values of the person before the onset of dementia. She registered her skepticism about the prevailing approach more than 15 years ago and has recently had an opportunity to elaborate on her views in a new report by the President's Council on Bioethics called Taking Care, Ethical Caregiving in Our Aging Society. Her topic today is Autonomy is Not the Answer, Rewriting the Law on Life-Sustaining Treatment for Dementia Patients. Please welcome Rebecca Dresser.
Well, my thanks to Richard Bonney for inviting me to give the Hoffman Lecture this year and for that wonderful introduction. That was a great uplifting statement about me. I hope I can live up to it. So I really welcome the opportunity to explore some important matters with you, and I really look forward to hearing your thoughts during the discussion period. My field today is primarily bioethics, and this field often focuses on the speculative, the symbolic, the exotic developments that really have little direct impact on people's lives. But our topic today is different. Many families face the confusing and difficult situation of deciding about life-extending interventions for incapacitated older relatives unable to make their own treatment choices. And many of us who are not now in that situation worry that it will happen at some future point. Besides being a personal and family problem, this is a big and expanding social problem. There is a large and soon to be larger population of people affected by dementia, and we are far from ready to cope. Today I'm going to offer some observations on dementia and the treatment situation. First, I'm going to describe problems with relying on autonomy to address this situation through living wills or what are also called instruction advanced directives. This is a case where somebody, while competent, capable, says, here's what I want you to do when I get dementia. Here's how I want to be treated. So I'm going to talk about shortcomings in that approach. And then some issues raised by alternative approaches to treatment decision-making for incapacitated patients. And then where I think some improvements might be made. So first, a bit of background. How did advanced directives, living wills, become the favored approach in the treatment setting? Well, during the 1960s and 70s, some of you weren't alive or were just tiny then, modern medicine was coming up with new ways to sustain human life, such as respirators and advanced ICU care. The perception was that doctors were using this technology indiscriminately, that they really hadn't developed good judgment about how to use their new powers. So people were very afraid about being kept on life support for too long in what they perceived as an undignified state. So a general legal rule emerged that in the contemporaneous situation, the patient with decision-making capacity should be able to decide, based on his or her individual values, whether the treatment would be worth it. So it seemed to follow logically then, if illness or injury made a patient unable to make treatment decisions, the next best thing would be to decide based on instructions that that person gave while he or she still remained able to think about the treatment situation. So living wills and other advanced directives developed so people could give these instructions. The philosophical support for advanced directives is generally based on respect for individual autonomy. And the advanced directive approach is also attractive because it seems to avoid putting the decision in the hands of others, people like doctors and family members. And this is seen as desirable because people are worried that it's too easy for family members and others to subordinate the patient's interests to their own concerns and values. Unfortunately, though, the philosophical and legal support for advanced directives ignores serious obstacles to putting them into practice. Empirical studies of advanced directives point to several practical problems. A major one is that most people don't make living wills. Despite great efforts at education and promotion, these things have been promoted since the 1970s. The instruction directives, now here I'm distinguishing between what are called proxy directives, where people say, here is the person I would like to make decisions on my behalf if I become impaired. I'm leaving those out of the discussion. I'm just talking about the living will instruction approach. The ones that are made tend to be quite general. They say things like, I don't want heroic measures if I'm seriously or terminally ill. So they fail to offer very much guidance to clinicians and families at the bedside. Some advanced directives do elicit more specific information. Some of you may have seen these very complicated documents with different treatment interventions down one side and lots of conditions across the top, and you're supposed to check off boxes for each one of those. But the concern then becomes whether the person completing such a document has an adequate understanding of the specific decisions that they're making. And I'll come back to this problem in a moment. A second general problem is that it's not clear that directives effectively and accurately communicate a patient's wishes. I'll tell you about a couple studies on that. One involved dialysis patients, and this study showed that people didn't necessarily want their advanced directives followed. This was a case where the subjects, I think it was around 100, were already on dialysis, and they were still competent. And the researchers asked them to make an advance directive specifying whether they would want dialysis to continue if they had advanced Alzheimer's. And then after the people made the advance directives, the researchers went back and said, "Do you want us to follow these?" And only one-third of the people said, we want our directives strictly followed. One-third said they wanted their families and doctors to have some leeway to override the directive. And another third said they wanted their families and doctors to have complete leeway to override the directives. So you might wonder why someone would make a directive. We can talk about that later. But anyway, in this case, the directive did not convey the majority of the maker's wishes in that, because the directive did not say, "I want you to have leeway to override this if you think some other decision would be better." Another study involved older people who were still competent, and they were asked to identify the relative they would want to be their surrogate decision maker if they became impaired. And then these older people were asked to fill out a questionnaire on life-sustaining treatment. They had four different life-sustaining interventions in nine different illness situations, so they wrote down their wishes. And then after that, the investigators asked the chosen surrogates, usually a spouse or a child, how to fill out this questionnaire in the same way they thought the older person would fill it out. Now, some of the surrogates, actually four groups of the surrogates, were able to either consult the older person's advance directive, or they could consult the directive and they were present when the older person was making the directive. Surprisingly, the surrogates able to consult the advance directive, or who were present during the discussion, did no better than the control group in estimating what the older person's answers would be on the questionnaire about life-sustaining treatment. So in this case, having the directive or even being present at the discussion did not add to the information that the close relatives already had about how they thought their relative would make treatment decisions. If anybody's interested, I have the citations to these studies. Another general problem is that people making directives often have a poor understanding of what they are deciding. Unless the person already has a specific life-threatening illness where there are sort of three or four or five different trajectories that could come up, it's very difficult to know all the treatment decisions that could come up in the future, much less have adequate information about those interventions. When you think about informed consent and you think about all the information that the people hope that patients understand when they make treatment decisions, imagine sitting here without a serious illness trying to inform someone about all these different treatment interventions in an adequate way. So that's another issue. A particular problem with dementia is that people making a directive may not envision how they would experience their lives with dementia in the future. So the question becomes, do people completing advanced directives, and even can they imagine what they would want in a future state of dementia or other impairment when they won't have the same concerns that they have now? The same kinds of things like reading the New York Times or playing squash or whatever will not be important to them in the future. But do they understand that, and can they imagine being in this different state? Also, they found that even in competent individuals, treatment preferences change, but people don't realize that their preferences have changed. So we tend to think we're very stable in our preferences, but when researchers do studies, they ask people their preferences, not just about treatment, but about lots of things. And then they go back a year later and they say, do you think you've changed? And people usually say no. And then they actually measure, they find that their preferences have changed, but people don't realize it. So the problem here would be somebody makes a directive, changes preferences, doesn't change the directive because they don't realize their preferences have changed. And then there are other implementation problems, such as half to two-thirds of advanced directives never make it into patients' charts. They may not be followed at the bedside when clinicians and families don't think they're appropriate. So a recent article in the Hastings Center report called Enough, The Failure of the Living Will. This is a quote from the authors. They review a lot more empirical data than I've just told you about. And they take the position that even if you assume philosophically that living wills desirably serve a strong version of patients' autonomy, living wills do not and cannot achieve that goal as a practical matter. So, in sum, despite its theoretical appeal, individual autonomy over future end-of-life treatment as a dementia patient, at least, and in other circumstances perhaps, may be too complicated to put into practice. Besides the practical problems, there are some moral and policy problems with relying on advanced directives. Certain advanced directives threaten the welfare of incompetent patients. In these cases, giving priority to the advanced directive would be detrimental to the patient in her current state. So you can talk about two kinds of cases here. In one case, a directive refuses a treatment that would effectively relieve an impaired patient's pain or discomfort, or would allow the patient to continue a life that appears to have value to her now. The flip side is, remember, advanced directives can ask for treatment. They're not just to refuse treatment. So someone asks for everything to be done, and the patient is diagnosed as terminal and is in the, expected to die soon, but it's not clear when. And if you give the treatment the patient asked for in the directive, it would be extremely burdensome on the patient. It would be very painful, distressing, might help sustain life for a few weeks, but would not seem to be in the patient's best interest now. So the question then becomes, which should take priority, the patient's previous choices while competent, or the incapacitated patient's best interests or welfare? Now, there are many writers, and probably some of you, who think that the past wishes should take priority. But I think based on the empirical data I've shared with you and other studies, I think we should ask whether the less than ideal decisions that are made about a future situation that we don't really know or understand, if they're the kind of informed and considered choice we would want in such an important situation. The question then becomes, how should we balance the moral significance of the patient's previous decision against the patient's current welfare? This balancing has to take into account a couple other moral duties we have, which one is to protect vulnerable, incapacitated patients. This is reflected in the parens patriae function of the law. And then also the anti-discrimination provisions of our disability laws. How do those play in? So it's not obvious to me that prior autonomy should always trump these duties in conflict situations. Now, besides threatening harm to individual patients, advanced directives have had a second negative effect on patient care. Because people like me, scholars and government officials, have tended to focus on advanced directives as the way to resolve future treatment questions, we've neglected the majority of actual treatment situations. The standards that should apply when patients don't have clear advanced directives, instruction directives, really haven't been very much developed. Let me say a bit about these standards. There are two of them. One is called substituted judgment. And this was first put forth by the New Jersey Supreme Court in the Quinlan case, which was the first major right to die case. This standard instructs physicians and families to make the treatment decision the patient would make if, and I'm quoting here, miraculously lucid for an interval, not altering the existing prognosis to which she would soon return, and perceptive of her irreversible condition. So they were talking about someone like Terry Schiavo in a vegetative state. If she could suddenly wake up, look around her, understand her prognosis, what would she want? But here, we don't have any clear advanced directive. So the judgment about what she would want is based on things like religious beliefs, prior attitudes to medical care, general values, that sort of thing. Now, critics argue that this substituted judgment standard is too mushy, that it can be manipulated to allow relatives and others to advance their own values and concerns in the guise of a decision that purports to be what the patient would want. To protect the patient, they say, the scope of decisions based on this standard should be limited. A couple of philosophers, Alan Buchanan and Dan Brock, have written, "The inherently speculative nature of substituted judgment, along with the vulnerable position of the incompetent patient, require that substituted judgment may not be used to justify a course of action that serves the interests of others at the expense of the patient's basic interests." So how do you figure out what the patient's basic interests are? Well, you have to turn to the final standard, which is the best interests objective standard. This approach is also called sometimes the benefit burden or reasonable person standard. Now, these standards are applied when everybody agrees we don't know what the patient would want. We don't have an advance directive. We have somebody who went to the doctor sometimes, didn't go to the doctor other times. You know, it's sort of a mixed bag, so nobody's really sure what the patient would prefer. So instead of trying to figure out what this individual patient would want based on his or her personal values, idiosyncratic perhaps values, the objective approach relies on community norms. It rests on a societal consensus or the perspective of a reasonable person, those of you in law school have heard of that before, choosing as most people would choose for themselves. Now, applying objective standards involves weighing the benefits and burdens that an incapacitated patient would experience if treatment were administered or if it were foregone. You look at things like pain and distress, pleasure and enjoyment, what will the patient's life be like if you give the treatment, what will the patient's death be like if you don't give the treatment, those kinds of things. Now, these standards are controversial because they require healthy people to evaluate the quality of life of vulnerable, impaired patients. Now, critics fear that objective standards will incorporate social worth and economic considerations. So these fears are part of the reason why people are so favorable toward advanced directives and substituted judgment to some extent, because if the treatment decisions seem to be coming from the patients themselves, what did they write down? What would they want if competent? then there's less reason to worry about other people making decisions based on money factors, inconvenience factors, psychological burden factors to them, those sorts of concerns. However, I think in reality, the fact that few people have directives, most of the decisions are actually being made based on a mushy substituted judgment decision, or just people trying to do the best they can. In reality, this is the situation we have and the situation we're usually going to have. So we just need to face it. So what I would like to do is for us to get better at this objective approach. And so I'm going to talk the rest of the time about that. What we need to do is work on clarifying the scope of permissible treatment decisions by family members and others at the bedside. The growing population of dementia patients increases the need for scholars and legal authorities to develop an objective standard that provides adequate protection to incapacitated patients, but also gives due regard to family concerns and values, as well as competing demands for limited societal resources. Now, this is not going to be easy. To apply objective standards, you have to have some agreement about what should count as benefits and burdens, and what combination of benefits and burdens justifies a specific treatment choice. But people have different views on these things. For example, should this approach allow foregoing interventions that appear to impose discomfort on dementia patients? Should it permit foregoing treatment in advanced dementia patients who seem to be comfortable but they're not very aware of their surroundings? In a diverse society like ours, I think complete consensus seems out of reach. Nevertheless, courts and legislatures have taken some positions, normative positions, on at least some of these questions. One example is, again, the New Jersey Supreme Court's been quite active in this area in a case called In re Conroy. It set forth an objective standard to apply when there's no trustworthy evidence of the patient's past preferences. And so in this case, the court said, treatment may be foregone if, and this is a quote, the net burdens of the patient's life clearly and markedly outweigh the benefits that the patient derives from life, and the recurring, unavoidable, and severe pain of the patient's life is such that the effect of administering life-sustaining treatment would be inhumane. Burdens to be considered include pain and suffering, while benefits are physical pleasure, emotional enjoyment, and intellectual satisfaction. So you weigh these things. Now, this formulation of the objective test has been criticized as too narrow. Nobody's really disagreed with it, saying, yes, you should continue to treat patients even if it's inhumane. But many people think there are other cases where it would be permissible. One of the justices in the Conroy case took this position, Justice Handler, and he said, even though the opinion talks about things like dignity and other considerations, the real focus is on pain. So pain is the only reason that allows you to forego treatment. He didn't think that was expansive enough, and he thought that other situations should be covered. So one situation that many people think should be covered is the case of the permanently unconscious patient. So this would be someone like Terry Schiavo, Nancy Cruzan, Karen Ann Quinlan. Because these patients are incapable of experiencing pain or suffering. If they're truly unconscious, they're not aware of pleasure or pain. They're not aware of anything. Also, another category is advanced dementia patients, many of whom are described as barely conscious, but they're not in pain. So if you apply the Conroy standard, you'd have to give them things like feeding tubes and other interventions. So the question becomes, how should objective standards apply to patients whose awareness is permanently absent or substantially diminished? Well, that people take different positions on this, and so do courts. The Supreme Court of Missouri from my home state in the Cruzan case said that prolonged life in an unconscious state is a benefit to the patient that outweighs any burdens. They said, look, Nancy's not in pain. She's not suffering. So why not keep treating her? Because, you know, that's a biological life is a benefit to her. Keep going. There's no countervailing burden to justify stopping treatment. The Wisconsin Supreme Court took a different position and said foregoing treatment in a permanently unconscious patient is permissible under an objective standard. A group from the Hastings Center gave a rationale for this latter position. They said patients who are permanently unconscious are unaware of benefits and burdens. The only possible benefit to them of life-sustaining treatment is the possibility that the diagnosis is wrong and that they might actually wake up in the future. Some people have said, and maybe they'll figure out a cure, a way to regenerate brain cells. So in any event, this group said the major considerations are whether a reasonable person in the patient's circumstance would find that this possible benefit, that there's been a misdiagnosis or some future cure might come up, as well as any benefits to others, would justify continued treatment. A related argument, something close to this, is whether objective standards should consider only burdens and benefits that the patient actually experiences, or should consider so-called reasonable person values and preferences. One view is that decision makers should consider factors such as pain, distress, discomfort, and dignity only if the patients themselves are consciously experiencing these states. So this version is very protective of impaired patients. It allows non-treatment only when the burdens of continued life with treatment outweigh the benefits from the patient's own perspective. So you're trying to step into the shoes and say, if I were this patient, which would be better just from an experiential level? But this version, again, is criticized as overly restrictive because it's not going to allow non-treatment when many perhaps reasonable people would choose this for themselves or their loved ones. The second, more expansive version of the objective standards allows decision makers to consider factors that reasonable people would see as relevant. So this more expansive version allows non-treatment of permanently unconscious patients on the grounds that a reasonable person might find unconscious existence insufficiently worthwhile to insist that it be prolonged. Even though patients in this condition are not aware of their situation, normative values like preserving dignity and the importance of consciousness and relationships to human life suggest that foregoing treatment is permissible. But then people who support this expansive version of the objective test standard have to ask, how expensive are we going to get? There's concern that if this standard allows decisions to rest on matters like dignity when the patients themselves are not concerned with dignity, think about even a moderately advanced dementia patient probably isn't too worried about that sort of concern. But a reasonable person might say, well, that's a very undignified state. So should we allow the values of reasonable, healthy people to enter into decisions about someone like a person with moderate dementia who's not concerned about dignity and seems to be okay with the kind of life he or she has? So One way to restrict this expansive version of the objective standard would be to do surveys of the general public. Some people have suggested that. So, for example, there have been many surveys on the vegetative state, permanent unconsciousness, and they always find that at least 80 to higher percent of people say, if I were in that state, I would want my family to be able to decide not to treat me, or if a family member were in that state, I would want to be able to decide not to treat. So one approach would be to do surveys on other kinds of conditions like advanced dementia to see what the survey said among the general public about whether they would want their families to have freedom to decide against treatment in those situations. But I think even if we were to go that route, we still have reason to worry because the reasonable person approach, again, allows healthy people to evaluate the lives of people with disabilities and illnesses. So healthy people have never personally experienced these situations, and they may assign inappropriately low value to life in these conditions, with these conditions. Another controversial issue is whether the objective standard should allow, take into account benefits and burdens to others besides the patient. So an earlier President's Commission on Medical Ethics thought that they should. And that commission said, the impact of a decision on an incapacitated patient's loved ones may be taken into account in determining someone's best interests. For most people do have an important interest in the well-being of their families or close associates. But another policy group in New York, we have a member of that group here if you'd like to talk to him, but they disagreed with that and said the interests of others should influence treatment decisions only if there's strong evidence that the average person would take such interests into account in making medical choices. So you think about how people feel about their families. Some people would make great sacrifices for them. Others would say, I don't care, you know. So where do people stand on this? In the real world, I think, of course, factors such as family burdens are likely to influence decisions at the bedside. But the moral challenge is to keep the patient's welfare in the picture central. Most scholars and officials agree that families should ordinarily be empowered to make treatment decisions for their incapacitated relatives. But they also support some limits on family choice, to guard against both over-treatment and under-treatment. Over-treatment is possible because family members could make a request for invasive and burdensome interventions out of guilt, a desire to avoid responsibility for the relative's death, or a desire to avoid the appearance of suspect motivations. But under-treatment is also a concern because empirical evidence shows that family members underestimate their elderly relatives' quality of life. If you ask the family members what the quality of life is, it's lower than what the older people say it is. These are older people who remain competent. So because financial and other burdens often accompany a decision to continue an incompetent patient's life-sustaining treatment, some families might be too eager to stop treatment to end their own ordeal. And this could be conscious or unconscious. So these concerns point to a need to restrict the family's discretion to continue or terminate an incapacitated patient's life-sustaining treatment. Commentators speak in terms of permitting families to decide, and these are quotes, within the range of medically sound alternatives as determined by appropriate medical standards, or another version of this, within a range of plans of care recognized as generally acceptable by professional and community standards. So these approaches could support classifying certain treatment decisions as outside the limits of acceptable family choice. But then the question is, which ones? This language that I read to you is pretty vague, generally acceptable by professional and community standards. So how about a family's refusal of surgery or chemotherapy for a patient with moderate dementia? Is that within their discretion? Is that something that clinicians might say, well, we don't like the decision you're making? In this case, dementia patients might not be able to understand why people are doing things to them or remember it, or they might not be able to understand why they have to stay in bed after a surgery for a few weeks. So these are real burdens to patients that have to be taken into account. Another case, should clinicians reject the family's refusal of oral antibiotics for a patient with mild dementia who retains the ability to enjoy many activities and relationships? Is that a case where if the family says no, clinicians should challenge, perhaps override? A third case is family refusal of tube feeding for patients who are more advanced, and this is a real issue for many families today. This option might not be covered by a narrow version of the objective standard because these patients usually are not suffering in any clear way. However, it's often defended as a reasonable choice in light of the questionable benefit that tube feeding confers on these patients. So developing a robust, objective approach to treatment decisions for dementia patients will require public and professional debate over cases like these. It will require an understanding of how different treatment interventions affect dementia patients. It will also require thoughtful deliberation about the complex moral dimensions of these cases. People with dementia have a progressive terminal illness, but they can live many years between the diagnosis, especially Alzheimer's, and the time when death is inevitable. And during much of this time, these patients are aware, and they're able to interact with the world. It's not like the Terry Schiavo, Cruzan situation. These patients are conscious for the most part. So they can be experientially harmed or helped by medical decisions others make for them. This new report, this is my show and tell, by the President's Council on Bioethics, delves into the details of many representative cases involving dementia treatment and offers different ways to analyze them. That's a couple of the chapters do that. The introductory chapter also describes the demographic situation we're facing. We are becoming, in the words of the report, a mass geriatric society. Isn't that wonderful? With the aging of the baby boomers, and it describes how we are unprepared to cope with the caregiving demands. So I invite you to examine the report. It's on the web at www.bioethics.gov, and you can order a copy through that or just print it out. I guarantee it will unsettle you and will probably provoke your thinking about caregiving before and at the end of life. So in anticipating our possible futures as incapacitated patients, and this can happen to all of us, I think we need to accept that we cannot exercise firm control over our later medical care, that we will, to a great extent, be dependent on others to protect us from harm. But I don't think that accepting this means we're helpless to prevent what we fear. Many of the fears that motivate people to make advance directives could be more effectively addressed, I think, by changing the policy and clinical contexts in which dementia and other incapacitated patients receive care. At the policy level, there need to be efforts to clarify the scope of permissible decisions by relatives and others at the bedside. an enriched and refined standard focused on patients' contemporaneous interests is needed to supply guidance in the clinical setting. Securing improvements in clinical care and for chronically and terminally ill patients is a second alternative to relying on advanced directives to provide a good death. During the 1990s, advocacy and medical organizations started a campaign to deliver better quality care to people with dementia and other chronic and life-threatening conditions. Among the goals of this campaign are to furnish all frail and incapacitated patients with treatment that promotes their experiential well-being and allows treatment to be foregone when this appears to families and clinicians to be a reasonable option for the individual patient. Humane and dignified care in this model is regarded as a community mission, instead of something that individuals need to address through an advanced directive. So this seems to me a more sensible and defensible way to plan for our possible futures as patients with dementia and other impairments. Thank you. And I'm happy to...
Rebecca's available to discuss what she said and to answer your questions, and of course she's a law professor, so she doesn't need me to moderate, and she'll do it herself. So, go ahead.
Yes, John.
Rebecca,
we all
say that the job of people in bioethics is to make life...
Can everybody hear, maybe...
All bioethics and philosophy are saying that our role is to make life more difficult. We've done a great job of that. I just want to discuss with you a little bit further your dismissal of a precedent autonomy position. You know that there's a disparity between, survey showed a disparity between the decisions that proxy decision makers make and the actual wishes that those polled patients would have wanted. I'm wondering, whether there might also be major disparities between what individuals would have wanted and what polls suggest a reasonable person would have wanted. So if we're worried about that sort of a gap or disparity, I'm wondering how this more objective position that you're trying to develop is really going to constitute a tremendous advance. And also, I'd like to know, too, the extent to which the state of the art of this kind of polling. You're citing the study. I haven't read a lot of this, but I'm just wondering how definitive this kind of these kinds of studies really are. One study, two studies, what?
Those are good points. This would be about whether we should look to polls to flesh out our idea about what treatment decisions should be accepted as reasonable. I think in my talk I made the point that we still have to be worried about these because here you have healthy people saying, I think... this is reasonable. This is a situation where families should be allowed to stop treatment. And there certainly is a danger that people will undervalue the quality of life of people with these conditions. So I certainly wouldn't endorse these polls as the sole basis for decisions. But I guess they do offer a little bit of support for the... if you take a narrow version of this best interest standard, which says you may only stop treatment if it would be inhumane to continue the treatment, or based on some, this patient is in some distress and doesn't seem to get any pleasure out of life. There are not a lot of dementia treatment dilemmas do not involve that situation. Some of them do, but it certainly, as you have written, John, wouldn't if you're talking about an advanced dementia patient or a patient in a vegetative state, it's very difficult to use that formulation of the best interest standard to justify foregoing treatment. Now, some people might say, well, that's fine. But I think a lot of people say, I find that repelling. I think, you know, my mother or lots of people I know wouldn't want this, and I want to have the freedom to say stop at that point, even though the relative is not severely suffering. So we have to figure out whether there's a moral justification for that, and how do we do that? Well, I think one way to do that is to say we live in a culture that finds this acceptable. There are enough values on the other side, like dignity, accepting mortality, accepting, say, with Alzheimer's, that this is a terminal illness, and this person is not going to get better. We don't see the point of continuing. So if you have some ideas for how, you know, some moral supports for getting out of the limited situation of inhumane treatment using an objective standard, I would welcome that. I'm just throwing out some of the ideas that I and others have come up with so far. But I think that's a very good point. Bill?
Your array of arguments against advanced directives is at a couple of levels. At one level, simply a lot of people don't fill them out. And a lot of caregivers don't know what the person filled out anyway under crisis circumstances and so forth. But the much deeper issue that you talk about is that people are not really competent to offer advanced directives about themselves, and they'll be incompetent because they do not appreciate in reflective persons the kind of joys that they may experience as unreflective people living immediately, which emphasizes the discontinuity between that advanced competent person and his later or her later incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I found it interesting looking at some advanced stuff out of the President's Council in which they developed that argument of discontinuity, because on the issue of stem cell research, the argument seemed to be the reverse. There is continuity in the pre-implanted embryo right on through the whole race. And therefore, you want to protect the patient against researchers who would want to destroy the pre-implanted embryo, because after all, this is a human being.
Mm-hmm.
That heavily depends upon the notion of continuity. Here, the very same President's Council, which in the majority vote urged a moratorium on the subject of research on advanced on pre-implanted embryos, now is arguing the reverse, emphasizing the fact that this continuity between the competent person and person under end-of-life circumstance. Now, what is the continuity between these two differing relationships to the question of continuity, discontinuity? It might be that one wants to protect the pre-implanted embryo from the assault of researchers at the one end of life, and at the other end of life, protect the people at the end of life from the attack of their earlier competent cells. So the real continuity is the protection of life, the culture of life approach. Very interesting issue, thinking of the continuing body of work issuing from the President's Council.
That's a good insight. It points out that underlying this question, as well as a lot of other moral questions, is personal identity. What is the person? So some people think that a fertilized egg is worthy of full moral status because that's just a phase of life, like being a teenager. And we were all embryos once. So they say people start then, and they should be protected throughout life. People who strongly support advanced directives also believe in a sort of a continuity so that if you write something down while you're still aware and able to think about these things, then that decision should be given the same weight as a contemporaneous treatment choice because that's the same person earlier who wrote down those wishes, and those wishes should trump other considerations. The other view is, well, that's a sort of a different person with dementia. That new person doesn't have the same concerns and values that the former person had. Now, in this report, this sort of tension is not, the embryos are not discussed, but this question of who is the person at these various stages is discussed. And it doesn't really come down in a clear way, one way or the other. But I think you don't necessarily have to accept this idea that it's a different person when the dementia treatment situation arises to question an advance directive. It's just, think about decisions that you make at one point in your life that you later want to change. You want to change your mind. So we could think about marriage. A lot of people get married and later they don't want to be in the marriage. They don't think that that's what's best for them, so they want to change their minds and get out of the marriage. Now, they're not a different person. The idea that we would respect their new preferences is accepted. We're not saying, well, they're a different person than they were before. We're just saying the person has changed and the preferences and interests have changed. So we want to take those into account. So you can make a similar argument with treatment. The person has changed, but now the person is incompetent, unable to say, hey, I've changed my mind. I want a different choice. So other people have to be around the patient and say, do we really think this is what he or she would have wanted? This situation is so different from what we think he or she had in mind. So I think you're right. It could play into a notion of altered personal identity, but I don't think it has to. Yes?
Actually, you would have to update your advance directive on a very regular basis, because not only do we as people change, and our opinions might change as new technology is available, which we might or might not have
foreseen.
Actually, the laws of the society in which we happen to live also stand in our way. We are now having a discussion about the right to end life in front of the Supreme Court judges. Why they would have a right to tell me how to end my life, I cannot understand. However, I am hampered and my decisions have to be modified by what can be done or cannot be done in the society in which I happen to live. If I say in my advance directives I want euthanasia, I cannot benefit from it.
That's right.
I can afford it to my dog, but I myself will have to see it through. We do not know whether people in a demented state suffer and have these considerations or don't. We presume to know. So while I believe in advance directives, I feel that whether they will be followed or not cannot be guaranteed. It depends on the attitude of my caregivers, in family, on my doctors, and most likely, in my particular case, they will not be followed because I will have to see it through.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think that's very perceptive. Yes, if you this is getting back to toward the end. Remember when I said many people support putting boundaries on the range of family choices, permissible family choices. So if you ask in your advance directive, I want a lethal injection if I ever get dementia, no one, unless they carry you off to a secret place and do it, or I guess Dr. Kevorkian's not available anymore, that won't be followed by clinicians. They would say, you know, we won't do that. Some of the so-called passive euthanasia, foregoing life-sustaining treatment, probably will run into that same attitude. So if someone were to put in an advance directive, if I am diagnosed with Alzheimer's, don't give me any food, or I want no medication, nothing. I think it would be difficult to get that followed. One of the discussion points in the report is you have to remember, for most of us, we're making these decisions and expressing these wishes in the context of a family and also in a clinical community. And the idea that we could just write something down and expect others to follow it like a recipe is really ignoring their own moral judgment and their place in the world. So the document does talk about the good sides of advance directives and endorses what we call, others have called this too, advance planning, which is when people sit down with their families and their doctors and talk not just about preferences on life-sustaining treatment, but living situations, financial issues, you know, all the other things that need to be considered about the future. And that can be very useful to families and clinicians later when the person is more impaired. And we also endorse naming a proxy decision maker, someone you trust who can be at the bedside and get that up-to-date information. Learn about new options. Make decisions based on the kind of information we talk about with informed consent. We endorse that as well, and we think that that's useful and realistic and easy to do, much easier than to sit down and try to write down this whole future plan of care, of treatment, when you just don't know what's going to happen.
I've got time for one more question. Dan?
Does the objective standard with polling or group decision-making, for example, address the lack of informed consent that you said was a shortcoming for people to fill out the interactive?
Could you say that again? I'm sorry.
People who fill out advance directives don't really understand a lot of what it is they're filling out, and they don't understand the pages that ensue.
Right.
And I wonder how polling people.
No. And if we were really going to do this, this is getting back to the first comment, I think we would want to develop some, here's some grant proposals, develop some really thoughtful polls where you had case scenarios and gave people a lot of information and background and then asked them what they thought of whether foregoing treatment would be reasonable or not. That would be interesting, but the polls that I know of so far are superficial.
Let me just make one observation. I think Rebecca's work for all these 15 years that she's been writing about this has called attention to the moral weaknesses of the proceeding autonomy approach, which I think even those of us that would like to give it as much weight and power as you can give it and take it as far as you can go with it would recognize that it has moral weaknesses of the kinds that she's just described. And you want, so you need something else. You need something else to try to help you make these decisions. And my guess is, I have not read the President's Council report, but if it's helped us move the ball forward in the way that Rebecca has just also tried to do, to help us think about coming up with some at least supplemental strategies for helping to resolve these questions where I think we've been afraid to go. That will be in advance. I mean, surely opinion polls are not going to be the answer, but if we can use that as a pieces of evidence that are going to be helpful, you know, that might move the ball forward, even though it's not going to provide the answers. So I think this has been very provocative, and I want to thank Rebecca for delivering the Hoffman Lecture, and thank all of you for coming.